So in case we haven't met yet, my name is Molly Burke. I'm an assistant professor at Oregon State University. I'm fairly new there. And I like to show this picture of beautiful Corvallis, Oregon on a rare non-rainy day because I'm recruiting, right? I'm building a lab group there. And the title that I chose for today, What Can We Learn from Experimental Evolution in Sexual Populations? It's a pretty broad title, and I don't presume that I'll be able to answer this question in any kind of comprehensive way today, or maybe even in my whole career, but it's a question that really motivates me. And it's a question that I think that the two experiments that I'm going to tell you about today, that I've done in the past, will bear on, and it's a question that really motivates me for future work that I'm starting up in my lab. So, experimental evolution. Last week we were lucky enough to get a talk from Andrew Murray in which he really eloquently justified the case for why experimental evolution is useful, and I'm not going to repeat that so much here other than just to say that experimental evolution is a means by which we can test hypotheses about the way we think evolution might be occurring in nature under controlled and reproducible conditions in the laboratory, right? And so these are hypotheses regarding questions like how repeatable is evolution, both at the phenotype and the genotype level? How effective of a method is experimental evolution for identifying genes underlying quantitative traits? And what are the origins and fates of adaptive alleles? So what is the evolutionary fuel upon which natural selection acts? And what ultimately happens to that fuel, to that variation over time? And so as Andrew said during his talk, he said there are two kinds of experimental evolution people, right? Those who deliberately start with clonal populations where everyone is initially isogenic, and he identified himself as part of that group. And there are those who deliberately start with populations in which there's lots of variation, standing variation that's segregating. So populations brought into the lab that are harboring variation that's representative of what might be in nature, and then watching how that variation evolves in the lab. So I guess I'd be one of those people, right? I'm of the latter category. Although I wanted to bring up this nice figure from a recent review paper that Olivier and Tony put together and others a couple of years ago in Nature Reviews Genetics. They break it down a bit further. So they actually review sort of four different types of evolution experiments, or evolve and resequence, which is the term that has basically supplanted experimental evolution with the incorporation of genomics, right? So we have these totally in vitro evolution experiments that are maybe CellX type experiments that are pulling, that are selecting synthetic molecules or like ligands. And then we have the classic microbial isogenic evolution experiments of the type about which we heard last week in several different talks. And then there are these other two types of experiments where we start with standing variation. And this paper sort of differentiates those that are microbial, because we can, of course, there are some types of microbes that are amenable to these kinds of experiments, like diploid yeast or C. elegans. And then the more traditional, higher eukaryotic model is Drosophila melanogaster. That's the most common metazoan model that is used in evolution experiments in the lab. And as I was rereading this paper to prepare for this talk, I came across the very last sentence, which is, the time is right for practitioners in the different systems to learn from one another. And that sort of rang especially true for me. I think that certainly being here at this meeting and learning from all of you who've given talks before me and just in informal chatting, I'm learning a lot from those of you who are working with some of these other types of evolution experiments. Okay, so like I said, today I'm going to tell you about two different experiments and in two different systems. The first system I'm going to tell you about, this is work I did as a graduate student at UC Irvine in Michael Rose's lab. And these are experiments with Drosophila, which again is the most common metazoan model for evolution experiments. So for those of you who may not be familiar with this system, it's a very long-standing system of experimentally evolved lines of flies. They all harken back to a common ancestor that was brought into the lab in the mid-70s from a vineyard in Amherst, Massachusetts. So these flies were sampled from nature, brought into the lab, and then used for many different evolution experiments that are, and some of those are ongoing today, right? So these are experiments that have been continuously evolving for decades. The most famous of these involves a selection on age of reproduction in a population. And this is the major trait that the Rose Lab selects upon directly. And for those of you who aren't familiar, that might seem like a bit of an abstract trait to select on, age of reproduction in the population. But if you think about it, fruit flies mature, they go from egg to reproductive adult in approximately 2 weeks. But that's a trait for which there is heritable variation in the population. And so in the lab, we can exploit that and select on that age. So if we keep fruit flies in population cages that are about this, you know, they're large enough, like shoebox sized in this picture, flies lay eggs on their food. So just by removing food every day in the lab, you can control pretty accurately the age at which a whole generation was of eggs was laid, what age that was, right? And so the most famous stock of these flies are those where the age of reproduction was selected to be later and later for successive generations until the total generation time had increased several fold, and lifespan had also correspondingly increased. So these are called the Methuselah flies because they live on average much longer than wild-type fruit flies. And these are the flies that I wanted to work on in the lab when I started in with Michael as a PhD student, because of course they're a fascinating resource to study in the context of the evolution of aging, right? They live about three times longer than the control populations that received no such selection treatment. But Michael, being Michael, said, absolutely not. I'm selling these and I'm turning them into a for-profit resource with an anti-aging pharmaceutical company. So those are off limits. But there are plenty of other stocks in the lab that have evolved similar life history traits and which were available to do experiments looking at the genomics of these long-established lines. And so just some other features of the Rose Lab system of flies that are relevant. All of the populations in the lab are maintained such that they're outbred. Populations are large, census size several thousand, and we have estimated effective population size to be on the order of 1,000. And they're all five-fold replicated, meaning that there are five independent replicates receiving the same selection belonging to a treatment. Okay. So like I said, I didn't work with the Methuselah flies per se, but I worked with different selected lines. They have these names, but you don't need to remember them. I will refer to them using these colors, red and blue, right? So the red lines were the selected lines. They had a generation time. An age of reproduction in the population was only 9 days. So this is sort of going the other direction as the Methuselah flies. So they have been selected for rapid development and they have a correspondingly shorter lifespan. And the control lines from which they were derived have this name CO, and they're on a much longer generational cycle. And by the time that I got to these flies in the lab, they had been around for many generations. So the selected lines had been evolving for 600 generations. And to give you some perspective, you know, these lines were begun in 1991, right? So with flies, which have a much longer generation time than, say, E. coli, right, these experiments are hard to do in reasonable amounts of real time. It takes a significant investment of time, of real time, to achieve an impressive investment in terms of evolutionary time. And the control lines had been around for fewer generations because, of course, their generation time is longer. So just to convince you that these two lines of flies do have very different phenotypes, what I'm showing you here are the average phenotypes from individuals collected from each of these selection treatments. So over here, we have the ACO lines on average have shorter development time, shorter generation time, which is the trait under direct selection. than the control lines. They are also smaller, they're less stress resistant, and they don't live as long. Okay, so the idea here was to go in and actually sequence these lines and see what's going on under the hood. Okay, to do this, we used a technique called pooled population sequencing, where we collected individuals from each of these treatments, pooled them together, extracted DNA en masse from them. And this is a technique that was talked about last week, but I kind of wanted to put a finer point on it because this is a really cost-effective way to query the genomes of individuals with large genomes, right? Because it's expensive to sequence individuals. So it's much cheaper to sequence them in pools. And so at the time that we did this experiment, we had to pool across replicates. So really, we just have two pools, selected and control. And in these pools, we're going to measure allele frequencies. But in order to answer questions about the repeatability of evolution, we also were able to sequence a third library, which was just a single replicate. And just to explain how this pool-seq technique works, this is all short-read Illumina sequencing. So from these pools of DNA, we create Illumina libraries and align them to the reference genome of Drosophila and identify SNPs that either differ from that reference or match. So in this experiment, we only are looking at biallelic SNPs. And then we're able to look at these two pools of DNA from the two from the selected and the control lines and ask, at any given SNP position, does allele frequency differ? And we can use statistical tests to look at that differentiation. Okay, and importantly, the amount to which we get good coverage at any SNP is our allele frequency, is the denominator in our allele frequency estimate, right? And so in this way, we're able to query genome-wide SNP frequencies in a selection treatment and in a control treatment and compare them. Any questions about that so far? Okay. So of course, one question that I might have asked is, how accurate is this really as a method for identifying individual identifying allele frequencies? And so to do that, you'd really want to look at individuals. You'd want to genotype individuals and measure allele frequencies that way and compare them to those measured via PoolSeq, just to verify that this is a viable strategy. So it's cost effective, but we also want it to be accurate, right? And so that's what this figure is showing you, that we did actually look at individual allele frequencies in individual flies from all of these treatments. So the blue squares represent those measured in CO flies or control flies, and the red circles represent allele frequencies measured in the selected, in flies of the selected lines. And there's this nice correspondence. And of course, since then, this has become a very popular method. Christian's group has written this nice manifesto for us. There's literally a box that's titled Best Practices that we can use as a resource for doing good PoolSeq experiments. And so some of those best practices include generating a pool of individuals that's at least 40, coverages that are at least 50x at every SNP, and read lengths that are fairly long, longer than 75 base pairs. So for this experiment, which is kind of old now, we were able to, this condition was satisfied, but these two actually weren't. We had fairly low coverage and low read lengths, but if you stick with me long enough, I'm gonna get to an experiment where we had much higher coverage.
What is roughly the density at which you have SNPs along the genome?
Yeah, so in this experiment, we had about 700,000 high quality SNPs. So about one every couple hundred base pairs in the fly genome.
So, do you really need 50x coverage here with so many SNPs? I mean, how do you define the coverage? How do you decide on the coverage?
Yeah, well, I think, part of the problem is that there's a pool with a bunch of individuals and your coverage should query all those individuals in the population, right? Or we want to try to get as many individuals. Hopefully, having deep coverage, we're sampling those individuals that are in the pool.
But I mean, if there's sufficient LD, then you don't need to sequence every SNP in every individual, right?
No, but
you would be hoped that they're independent.
Well, I mean, after 500 generations or something?
Well, in the beginning, if your SNP occurs at a high enough frequency in the founder population, and then you could have very, really low LD in outbred populations of Drosophila, 200 base pairs or something like this.
Okay, that's what you see.
Well, that's the idea, the hope. Reality is different, but...
Yeah, and later on, you know, I'll get to experiments where those LD blocks are much smaller, and then it, I think, is maybe even more relevant.
Right? It's a little hard to know what the LD is in PoolSeq. That's the kind of one weakness of it, right?
Well, right. It's hard to use PoolSeq to identify haplotype or linkage information because we don't have phase, you know, the ability to phase. But that being said, in these populations, other experiments have given us a sense of what LD should be, which ranges from about 20 to 100 kb, probably on the higher end of that range. Okay, so I'm going to move on here. So when I give this talk, I like to zoom in on this figure before zooming out to look at the whole genome. So what I'm showing you here are the results of our statistical test between these two pools, right, selected and control, at all of these SNPs. Although, like Michael said, you know, we can use linkage information to help us in a few ways. So the fact that these are actually groups of linked SNPs together allows us to do things like take a moving average of these p-values. So what I'm showing you on the y-axis is transformed p-value such that higher values indicate higher significance, and on the x-axis, this is just genomic location. And so this black line represents, you know, any differentiation that exists between the selected and control lines, and the gray line down here represents the differentiation that exists between the single replicate with respect to the whole pool. So just looking at this black line, we see several peaks which correspond to these regions of SNP differentiation between these two pools. And you know, this is just sort of a visually helpful threshold beyond which we think these peaks are informative in terms of what genes might be underlying those peaks and maybe contributing to this phenotypic differentiation that we see. But really the most interesting thing about this figure, I think, is the fact that this gray line down here is evidence that there's negligible differentiation between a single individual replicate population compared to the rest of them, right? So this is evidence of convergence at the DNA level among independent replicates experiencing the same selection treatment.
Well, can you comment a little bit on the underlying null model for these p-values? Is that just a simple drift model? So, does that assume that the sites are independent, or does that already take correlation between sites?
So this is just a so there are only two groups, right? And so this is a simple sort of Fisher's exact test, and then the p-values are basically averaged in a sliding window type way. There isn't really a null model that we're using here, because you know we really only have these two samples. And so I think with other experiments, we're able to do a better job of, that are designed a little better at generating sort of an empirical null threshold. This is, like I said, more of a visually helpful threshold. It's just, it corresponds to a marginal significant threshold of 0.1%, right? But the fact that these SNPs are not independent and are segregating together in these groups approximately 100 kb, provides these nice peaks that give us a signal that these are popping out. Right?
Do you have any information for why the black line never dips as low as the gray line?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that they're just very, very different. And you know, again, these p-values are averaged, essentially. And so perhaps that's one of the reasons why these don't dip quite so low. But I think that the answer is just that there's a really dramatic differentiation at these markers.
I would guess it's the number of reads. You just have far fewer reads when you only look at HCO1, or am I wrong?
No, so
reads, as high as
density of reads, coverage, all of these things were comparable. across the three different treatments that we have, although these represent pairwise comparisons, right? So both the pools and then the ACO1 pool.
No, but you have less ACO1 reads than you have CO reads.
Less ACO1 reads than...
No, you're saying you have the same. You did ACO1 to the
totally
same.
Separately, yeah. I don't think there are fewer reads in that.
Okay,
pool.
So you went just as deep there. Yeah. And didn't add those into the ACO. You have a separate ACO1 where you don't overcount ACO1 and you don't include those reads. So.
Oh, I see what you mean. I get it. No, so those were excluded from that analysis, yeah.
Gotcha. So I was also curious, how much does coverage vary on this plot?
Yeah, variation in coverage. I don't remember that off the top of my head. But again, coverage wasn't great in this experiment. This is kind of an old experiment by today's standards, and we've done better since then. So average coverage was 20x, and sites with very low coverage and very high coverage relative to that average were excluded. Even if the variation in coverage isn't great, this is pretty low coverage for a pool-seq experiment.
But you're excluding out. So when we see peaks here, they aren't regions that are like high coverage, so you can detect smaller differences. These are differences. The peak should reflect differences in effect sizes rather than differences in power.
Well, we hope so. Yeah. Okay, so in addition to doing these tests of allele frequency differentiation, which require this pairwise comparison, right, selected versus control, we can also look at I think I'm getting ahead of myself. So I need to zoom out now and show you the whole genome, but everything I said with regard to the previous slide holds true across the five major chromosome arms of Drosophila. So we see lots of differentiation between the two pools, negligible differentiation between the selection, the individual replicates of a selection treatment. And these peaks, you know, there are many of them, right? So many of them are notable and they correspond to, probably about 500 genes, if we were to just count the genes underneath these regions that are peaky, and about as many non-synonymous SNPs, which would be candidates to follow up with in terms of identifying the functional significance of any of these alleles that might be contributing to these really dramatic phenotype differences. Now, in addition to this kind of work, we can also survey these populations in terms of their genome-wide nucleotide diversity and look for signatures of selection in the way that we do, for example, in human populations. So we have this data that's fairly high coverage, and we can look across the genome and ask, for example, what happens to heterozygosity and regions where nucleotide diversity or heterozygosity is low might correspond to regions that have been recently under selection, right? And so to explain that a little bit better, I like to highlight the classic definition of a selective sweep. So this is the case in which a beneficial mutation arises after the imposition of a novel environment. And because it has a selective advantage, it confers a fitness advantage. It increases in frequency in a population until it reaches 100%, right, until it becomes fixed. And if this happens in a population, as we scan along the genome looking for nucleotide diversity, we would expect that regions that correspond to those selective sweeps should have reduced nucleotide diversity or reduced heterozygosity. The fact that the causative sites have swept should result in this trough in diversity where linked sites also are expunged of variation. And so this is what we were able. This is what we did in these populations. We went along the genome and looked for this signature of reduced heterozygosity. So the blue line represents the control pool, the control lines. The red lines represent the selected lines, and the gray lines represent the single replicates. And so a few points to make here. First of all, there are a lot more heterozygosity dips in the selected line compared to the control. That's totally consistent with this idea that there has been recent positive selection in those lines, right? Also, the fact that this gray line very nearly mirrors the red line suggests, again, evidence of convergence at the molecular level. And so because I like to gauge how well my listener comprehension is, and I know there are students in the audience, I wanted to throw out a question for the students. I want to know what you think. So in the previous slide, I kind of set you up to believe that these heterozygosity troughs should go all the way to zero, right? They should go all the way down here. But these, what we observe, in fact, are not that. They're local losses in heterozygosity. So why do you think they're so shallow? Why aren't they deeper? Any of the students want to give that question a shot? Because there are several possibilities.
What is the window size?
The window size is about 100 kb. Okay. No, I want to see if anybody else has a.
Are you getting recombination halfway through? So like if instead of going to zero halfway through, it's having a cut in the middle and it's only half of it's going halfway.
That would make sense if different populations in which different alleles are increasing in frequency recombine. But we don't think that's happening. We think that these populations are completely separate. But that was, maybe that leads me to one possibility here. That one possibility is that if there is some small degree of migration between these replicates, then that might sort of homogenize these signatures of heterozygosity. We hope that's not happening, and we don't think that that's happening, but it's a possibility we have to acknowledge given that this was a 20-year-long experiment.
Is polyploidy an observable phenotype?
Sorry, what's that?
Is polyploidy?
Polyploidy, no.
Wasn't a full sweep?
It wasn't a full sweep, right. So that's one possibility. So if the allele under selection just hasn't made it to fixation yet, this is the kind of thing we might expect. So this is a fairly long experiment, 600 generations, and while that represents a significant amount of evolutionary time, perhaps it's not long enough for a mutation under selection to reach complete fixation. So that's certainly a possibility. Another possibility is that and this one, you know, requires a little bit of knowledge about, population genetics models. But if what is driving evolution is not these new mutations, not these de novo beneficial mutations that pop up after the imposition of a new environment, and in fact, evolution is acting to increase standing variants, the frequency of standing variants that were already present in the population prior to that environment shift, then these adaptive alleles should be present on many genetic backgrounds. And the fact that these alleles are present on many genetic backgrounds results in linked flanking diversity that will be different, interfere with this ability to get the signature of a nice classic sweep. So the fact that we don't see these dips all the way down to zero, there are several possible explanations for why that might be the case. Our favorite one is that perhaps these are so-called soft sweeps from standing variation. So as we zoom out and look at the rest of the genome, this is essentially, holds true for the rest of the genome. There are more local losses of heterozygosity in the selected lines. These losses correspond to regions where there's the most allele frequency differentiation, and the single replicate of ACO1, the heterozygosity patterns look very similar to that of the whole pool. Question.
So if you start decreasing the window size, does that dip like go down in the way you would expect if it is like, you know, a sweep based on standing variation? Like there should be some scaling relation, right, between
They do get smaller. However, when we go in and look at the most significantly differentiated SNPs, those are not fixed necessarily, right? Most of those most significantly differentiated SNPs, if you look at individual flies, which we did some work to genotype individuals, there is still variation segregating even at that level. So even if you could narrow the window size down to one, we would get troughs that look much closer to zero, but the alleles that we think selection is operating on are not devoid of variation. So this polymorphism persists.
So you think that S over R, selection coefficient over recombination rate, is much bigger than your window size, so you would actually expect it to go to zero? Because if it wasn't
then wouldn't it be the case that even if it was all hard sweeps, it still wouldn't go to zero in a 100 kb window if S over R is not bigger?
Yeah, right. So you bring up a good point, which is that, you know, the size of these troughs is also going to depend on the selection coefficient at the allele. And so, you know, if the selection coefficients are small, then, you know, perhaps that we're not in the right parameter space to see these alleles fix anyway.
Well, not the alleles fixing, but the diversity going to zero, because even if the allele fixes, it's only going to drag kill variation within a S over a window, isn't it just S over R, or something on that order?
I think it's, you know, when the size of the trough should be like 1/10 the magnitude of the selection coefficient in units of recombination. Right? So I think that, you know, this brings me to another point, which I want to get to, which is just that I don't think that this experiment is allows us to draw, it's a great experiment for many reasons. You know, this represents an elite resource in terms of what we have in the experimental evolution world with metazoans, but it doesn't really exist in a great parameter space for us to make strong inferences. And there are some ways in which I think that we've been able to improve on that since then.
Sorry, there's one thing that really confused me. So if you were to go to just your starting population, algorithm, diverse population, I would have expected if you look at very small windows, there are going to be some places in the Drosophila genome that are very conserved, and you just don't see any variation.
Right. Well, we're not querying those at all, because we're just looking at SNPs.
So this is normalized per SNP, not per nucleotides in the window.
The windows correspond to distance, genomic distance, and since the SNPs are fairly uniformly distributed, that seems to be a reasonable approach. But a better way might be scaling the window size by genetic distance.
So all the non-invariant sites are excluded from the analysis right from the get-go.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just not so familiar with that.
Sure. No, and I invite your questions. I want to make sure that everybody's on the same page.
So I'll add one comment here is that in these, unlike a lot of the other talks, these fly populations, the population sizes are maybe 1,000, maybe 500. So that kind of puts a limit on how small S could be, right? If S is smaller than 1/5, 1/n, then it's kind of invisible.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm familiar with like these debates and about why we don't see more signatures of adaptation in humans, and there's this hypothesis that there's many, many loci being selected for that are involved in height, for example, or whatever, and they're all shifting a little bit.
But in these populations, it's really hard for those really small things to not be neutral because of the population size being in the hundreds, not the millions, right? So for small selection coefficients...
Well, the argument with humans is that the affected population size 10,000, which I guess is a lot bigger than... It's still bigger than flies, but I'm not to say that's...
Well, there's a little bit of a problem with the numbers in humans, with those things that small and population sizes that small. But yeah,
I'll push back on that a little bit, because I mean, what you're saying is true if there's no LD between selected sites at all. You know, if there's, you know, if you have enough selected sites, then there's going to be LD, and so the effective selection pressures acting on them, you know, is going to go up. And so the fact that they, you know, if you have a dense enough weakly selected sites, then you can get much stronger. I mean, then their selection matters because there'll be an LD at random with other stuff, and you know, you can get square root of n kind of increases in those.
But we'd like to, I think the field needs more explicit modeling of these things because it's very delicate, right?
Agreed.
Yeah.
So what's in your next slide?
What's that?
What's on your next slide?
Okay, so on the next slide, so as I pointed out, I think multiple times, you know, we didn't query all of the independent replicate populations of the selected treatment. But since that experiment was done, we've been able to sequence all of the selection treatments in Michael Rose's lab, not just the ones that I'm telling you about today. But because only two of those lines are relevant for this talk, I'm going to pull out those data and show them to you. So in an experiment with much higher coverage, we were able to sequence we have sequenced data at about 50x coverage for all of the ACO selected lines and all of the CO control lines. And again, once we have sort of the full set of data from all of these independent replicates, I think that all the conclusions I drew from the first experiment hold true. So again, this is heterozygosity at SNPs. The number of SNPs differs a little bit in this experiment, but the underlying biology is the same. So heterozygosity dips do get closer to smaller values. They do get deeper. And I think that perhaps this is just this is a combination of the fact that we have deeper coverage, so more accurate allele frequency estimates, and also we aren't averaging across replicates. We have independent data from each of those replicates.
Did you do some simulations to see whether the similarity across your control populations is higher than you would expect, just by drift?
By drift? No. Not in these populations. But I think that, you know, the fact that they're so similar is a pretty striking argument against drift.
But you would expect drift. If you have your replicate control populations, there should be drift.
But shouldn't that make them diverge rather than converge?
Yeah, exactly. I'm asking, do you find more than you would expect? That's my point. My gut feeling is because of drift, I would expect more dissimilarity among control populations.
Right. So simulations that have been done in different lines of these labs in this lab suggest that no, this is overwhelmingly selection, not drift. But I admit that those simulations were not done in these two.
But you're not expecting selection in control. You will have selection there.
Well, here's the whole problem with these experiments, right? Is that these are not great controls. They're lines that have been evolving in the lab for decades, for a specific age of reproduction. So, this is another way in which this is not a strong inference experiment, because we don't have DNA from the ACO ancestor. The best point of comparison that we have is this other population that is the most recent ancestor, but not really an appropriate control.
And it itself is under selection.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm just curious whether.
No, and that leads me kind of right into my next point, although I did want to sum up this part of the talk with some conclusions. So I'm going to return to those three questions that I threw out at the very beginning of my talk, right? These are the three hypotheses, or three questions regarding hypotheses about how evolution works. That I'm very interested, right? So how repeatable is evolution? Well, if you take the data from those replicate populations at face value, it would seem as though it is quite repeatable in these populations. How well can we localize or identify QTL? Well, not really that well so far in these populations. There are dozens of peaks of allele frequency differentiation and hundreds of genes under those peaks. So it's a daunting task indeed to try to identify their functional significance one at a time.
Sorry, I just had a question related to Christian's question. Is that the repeatability seems actually greater in control than in the selected lines? That they seem actually more alike among replicates? So what do you think? I mean, does it mean, I'm not sure what it means then. Do you think it's... Yeah.
Well, I think that, again, the problem with the Rose Lab lines is that they're each sort of group of lines is a selection treatment, and none of them is really appropriate as a control. But we are limited to make comparisons to the sort of derived group and the other selected line from which they were derived.
I'm just wondering whether let's say controls are in fact it's a selected regime. I'm just wondering what would be a biological explanation for why this selection regime leads to more repeatable patterns.
Those are shown from the same real time point, right? Yes. Those are the endpoints, right? Mm-hmm. So there have been fewer generations of divergence in the control treatment.
Yeah, okay.
So less divergence.
Okay,
so
okay.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then so we think that we've identified evidence of repeatable evolution. We haven't gotten really down to the QTN or you know anywhere near that. And what are the origins and fates of adaptive alleles? Well, the evidence we've collected so far leads us to suspect that the origins of adaptive alleles are in standing variants. So we think that the alleles under selection are previously existing standing variants, and that they don't completely fix. So polymorphism is maintained even after hundreds of generations of selection. However, for sort of reasons I alluded to, we don't really have a whole lot of power to say either of those things with a great deal of confidence. And so we need other experiments. So flies, of course, are the most tractable metazoan model for evolution experiments in sexual populations. They're higher eukaryotes. They're able to maintain standing variation and continue to shuffle it through sexual recombination. So it's appropriate for testing questions about sort of the relative contribution of new mutations versus standing variation to a selective regime. But on the other hand, it really sucks as a model system for many reasons. It's really hard to keep population sizes large enough so that a new mutation is likely in any given generation. The generation time is pretty long, so even the shortest generation times are longer than a week. So that means, you know, as a new investigator thinking ahead, it's not a very enticing prospect, right, to start a new multi-decade experiment in flies. And it's also, you know, practically, even though flies are easy to take care of in the lab, it's practically pretty difficult to maintain, you know, either really big populations or lots of independent replicates. And so, of course, E. coli are the gold standard in terms of practicality. Really beautiful, clean experiments have been done with these microbes because they have short generations. They're archivable, so a complete sort of DNA fossil record is, and actually not just DNA, right? The organism can be cryopreserved, and a living fossil record can be generated of these experiments over time. And evolution can happen really fast. But in these systems, we're limited to observing adaptation occur mutation by mutation, right, in a stepwise fashion. And so these models are not amenable. These experiments are not amenable to asking questions about, say, the relative contribution of new mutations versus standing variants. And they're not that generalizable to higher taxa in the way that we would like. But luckily, there are a few models that sort of exist in the middle here, like Saccharomyces cerevisiae. As Greg pointed out last week in his talk, you know, they can be in the laboratory made to outcross and shuffle genotypes with sex. And other models are capable of this too, you know, worms and some other systems too that I'm forgetting at the moment. And so they represent this nice hybrid system that have features of microbial evolution experiments like short generation times and cryopreservation, but also are able to harbor and maintain standing variation with regular outcrossing, regular sex. So this is an experiment I did in Tony Long's lab at UC Irvine. We used this panel of Saccharomyces cerevisiae strains called the SGRP, the Saccharomyces Resequencing Project strains. They've been collected from all over the world, and they represent the geographic diversity in cerevisiae. And we, in collaboration with Gianni Leedy, who has published a great deal on these strains, used a recombinant population made by crossing four of these strains that sort of reside on these different clades of this phylogeny. So they're fairly diverse. They have about 1% SNP divergence among them. And Gianni created this resource, which he calls the SGRP4X, which is not a great name. But it is a recombinant population that is diploid and harbors haplotypes from these four sort of founder parent types. And it's been engineered such that the mating type switching locus has been knocked out, so it's stable and heterophthalic. And it also incorporates auxotrophic markers on different chromosomes so that it's fairly simple to isolate either haploids or mated diploids on selective media. And so using this resource, which again was created by crossing four of these haploid parents to generate a highly recombinant diploid strain that could be used as the base population for an evolution experiment. We initiated a 12-fold replicated experiment using the SGRP4X as a base, and we let it evolve in the lab, regularly maintaining outcrossing. And so yeast biology prevents us from imposing outcrossing every single cell division. Of course, yeast have to grow sort of in between. But by essentially starving them, you can make them sporulate. And then by using these combinations of selective media, you can identify mated diploids. And so this happened on a weekly basis. So what we had was 18 weeks of growth that involved some periods of clonal expansion that were interrupted by these mating events, by these forced outcrossing events. And because this alone is a pretty novel life history, this itself was the selection treatment in this experiment. So really it's more of a domestication experiment than a traditional selection experiment in the evolve and resequence sort of context. So what we were able to do was pool seek on all of these 12 replicate populations at three different time points. And these three different time points were approximately equally spaced out and representative of 6 weeks, 12 weeks, and 18 weeks for approximately 180 generations of vegetative growth, 360 and 540.
What medium did you grow them in?
These are in rich media. So. But the diploids were recovered in minimal media.
Sorry, I'm very ignorant. What is outcrossing?
So just making them sporulate. So when yeast sporulate, they sort of produce the products of meiosis. So we get four haploid gametes, and then we can mechanically disrupt the cell wall and randomly mix those four gametes.
Okay,
so they're completely randomly mating at every cycle. So that's what I mean by outcrossing. And so we think we've done a pretty good job of preventing things like that inter-ascus mating, which would lead to inbreeding. And we think we've done a pretty good job at killing off any of the cells that are dividing without having sex. Okay, so now we have a pretty rich data set, right? We have pool seek data from the ancestor, and then from these three different time points, times 12 different replicates. And so this presents, of course, an analysis challenge, and we took three different tacts to analyzing these data. Number one, we looked for candidate de novo mutations, because now that we're working with a more tractable microbial model, we think we can keep these experimental populations at a pretty high size. We did our best to estimate what that size was on a weekly basis. We think it was on the order of a million cells that were getting bottlenecked at any given point in the protocol, but we may have had smaller population sizes than that. So if these population sizes are sufficiently big, then in theory we should get both the action of standing variation and selection on potentially new mutations that are beneficial. So we looked for that. We looked for de novo mutations that were not present in any of the parent founders or the base population, but were present in the evolved populations. And we found a very little evidence for that, only 15 of these candidate de novo mutations. And none of them really got to very high frequency throughout the course of the experiment. And none of them were completely private to a single replicate, which means that actually they probably were present in the ancestral population and we just didn't catch it. So we've sort of, we have not seen these nice signatures of mutation sweeps like Greg showed us last week. On the other hand, there's of course lots of standing variation in these populations, on the order of 75,000 high quality SNPs that we can identify. And so now the challenge is how do we sort of identify a signature of change in all of those allele frequencies over time. And so our approach was to fit linear models to those allele frequency changes using time as a continuous variable, using time as a predictor. And so this sort of takes into account many assumptions. It assumes that alleles that are under selection are going to increase in a linear fashion. But we tried several different models, including those that incorporated a quadratic component in case there was some kind of eventual plateauing in allele frequencies, and these seem to fit the same. And when we do these, when we fit allele frequencies to linear models, we can also fit those same models to completely randomized sets of data. So we have three time points times 12 replicates, so that's 36 sort of samples of data, and we can shuffle those vectors of allele frequencies to generate a completely random null distribution of data and apply those same models to that null distribution, and in that way come up with a much more statistically rigorous genome-wide threshold for significance than I showed you previously. And then the third tack that we were able to take advantage of to analyze these PoolSeq data are haplotypes. So because we know the founder sequence of each of the four parent each of the four parents, we can estimate in the evolved lines, in addition to individual SNP frequency data, which haplotype does a particular chunk of the genome most likely belong to, and then look for regions in the genome where certain haplotypes might be overrepresented as a function of time. So in this cartoon example, if one of the parents goes to high frequency, if a whole haplotype goes to high frequency, in theory we should have more power to detect that than just by looking at individual SNPs.
Is there structural variation in this?
Yeah, good question. So PoolSeq is notoriously not great for identifying structural changes in structural variation.
But the initial strains are pure, right? So
sorry?
The initial four strains are pure populations, right? Like you,
mm-hmm.
So if you make a multiple sequence alignment. Okay.
Are the genes
in the same place in the four, or they move around?
No, so I think what we can do is a technique that Greg brought up last week, which is that we can look for differences in coverage. So there's going to be variation in coverage along the genome, and if we get really high coverage in one spot, so if a lot of reads are aligning to one location in the genome relative to everywhere else, then that could be evidence of a duplication. And this is what you can see in other experiments that don't feature this regular outcrossing or the complete absence of coverage at a region. We didn't see that in these data. So we see very little evidence of coverage increases or decreases.
And the general architecture of the genome is the same. Like, it's not like half of the genes are shuffled around in the chromosomes in one of the four or something. Like, I have no idea how synthetic these type of genes are to each other.
Well, so we're using short reads. So, we're limited in our ability to, we just use short reads mapped to the reference. So,
it means in the parent strains.
Right, in the parent strains, yeah.
How synthetic are the parent strain genomes?
There's a recent paper from Gianni's group, pretty synthetic except for the tubers.
Okay.
Where they've done whole genome summaries. Just a couple months.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks. So, right, so, and I guess I should point out that prior to having those de novo assemblies, we were using this reference genome that is the reference that everybody else uses for Cerevisiae, which is the lab strain, which is going to be considerably different from these diverse strains collected from all over. But the de novo assembly, I guess, suggests that that's okay. Okay, so now I'm going to show you the results first of these sort of linear modeling tests. So again, this is the same kind of structure in terms of the figure I showed you, the figures I've showed you before. So we have, significance on the y-axis, genomic location on the x-axis. Now, of course, we have 16 chromosomes to look at. And so these peaks of consistent allele frequency differentiation over time do emerge, and we can identify two of them that very clearly exceed our genome-wide false positive threshold, corresponding to a 5% rate, and a few more that emerge when we relax that threshold a bit. And of course, linkage in these lines is much lower. You know, blocks of LD are much smaller in these yeast populations because recombination is so efficient in yeast compared to flies. So even though, and there have been, I think I've neglected to mention this, but there were 12 rounds of outcrossing before this experiment even started to really mix up these genotypes. So in theory, haplotype blocks should be fairly small in the order of 10 kb or so. So when we incorporate the haplotype analysis into this as well and look for a signature of haplotype frequency change across the genome, just looking at the most advanced time point compared to the ancestor and taking that difference, we do see the same peaks emerge. So that would be sort of A through E and some more. And so I wanted to highlight that this suggests that the utility of haplotype information wherever it is possible in experiments with sexual organisms, because we have more power to detect regions of change when we're using more information along the genome. And just as an example, this peak here, G, I think it is. So here's a peak on chromosome 7 that we don't see if we just were to look at SNPs. And it turns out that that's a region where there's really low SNP coverage because this is a region that maps to a retrotransposon sequence in the Cerevisiae reference. And so PoolSeq is not great at mapping to repetitive regions like this retrotransposon element, this TY3 element is. But by using information from multiple SNPs to infer haplotypes, we can recover this signature of change. And so it turns out that this blue haplotype, and I guess I forgot to name these populations, but this happens to be an Asian Saki strain of yeast. This blue strain harbors that TY3 element, and the other three don't. So across the genome, we see evidence of certain haplotypes increasing and contributing to this differentiation. Usually, it's just a single founder haplotype that is driving this change, although over here, one of these peaks appears to be driven by change in two different haplotypes.
So you have this FDR control on the top plot, but not on the on your bottom one?
Say that again, sorry.
So you have this FDR control lines on the top plot, but not on the bottom one?
Right, so I guess I should have added. So the way in which we inferred the haplotypes doesn't lend itself to the same kind of permutation testing that we did to determine these thresholds up here. But we did determine that a genome-wide false positive rate would be on the order of 0.2 for this difference that we calculated between haplotypes. So perhaps I should have added that in. But I think it's pretty obvious that these haplotypes are really popping out.
But Molly, I'm not sure I understand your things. The number of SNPs are basically the same in both plots. So I find it difficult that this explains the presence of the peak G in one but not in the other. I think the reason may be a different one, that you basically make different assumptions on what you're testing. In the first plot, in the upper one, you test for consistency across the replicates, whereas in this lower one, you basically get rid of this condition. You ask, could it be that in a single replicate, I see a different trajectory than I see in the others, which you see in G? So I think you've tested.
I don't think that's, and I think perhaps I did a poor job of explaining what we did. So actually, no, this plot is showing consistent haplotype changes as well. So the way that the haplotypes are inferred are by using, you know, 10 kb worth of SNPs to predict the most likely founder haplotype for each of the four parents at every spot along the genome. And then those founder haplotypes were averaged across the replicates, and the total difference between the ancestral allele frequencies, which were approximately 25% at every genome location, right, in terms of the four founders, and the end of the experiment, so that week 18, averaged across all the replicates. So that is what is being plotted here, is that difference. And so these differences do reflect consistent changes across all of the replicates in terms of both SNPs and haplotypes.
One is averaged over 10 kb, while the other one is steep for steep. Is that particular?
Right, and so these up here are not, there's no sliding window at all.
So for G, which is the TY3, what frequency is it reached by the end of the experiment?
Of the actual element?
Yeah, I mean, because it's the haplotype that contains that's being selected.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I admit I don't know that we haven't looked at that. I don't know.
It's not like the transposon is duplicated, right?
Well, the coverage, I mean, we don't really have good, the coverage data don't suggest that. It would take isolating individual clones and doing Sanger sequencing, I think, or targeted sequencing.
But the transposon is alive or is dead? Like, is it an active transposon?
No, I believe it's inactive. Okay, so I think I'm going to move on. So I just wanted to point out, although I think in this audience I probably don't have to, that you know it's really nice that we're able to localize these peaks to much smaller regions than we could in the flies, and this results in a much more manageable number of SNPs to follow up with from a sort of functional validation point of view. So for example, this peak C, the most significant peak in the data set, only harbors a handful of SNPs that are exceeding these significance thresholds. And it's fairly easy to go in and characterize them one at a time and ask where do they reside. Are they intergenic? Are they in genes? Are they non-synonymous, et cetera? And we can even ask things like, do they reside in sites of the genome that are sensitive to cleavage by DNase-1? These most significant sites in the whole data set, in fact, do correspond to such regions, implying perhaps that these are candidates for increased transcription factor binding. And so, and also we, like I said, we can identify these regions that are genic. These happen to reside in a gene called MLP1. It's really difficult to sort of ascribe functional significance to these genes. I think like Andrew said in his talk last week, if you squint, some of them make sense. Some of the mutations that we identify occur in, say, genes that are associated with sporulation, which we would think would be important in this experiment. But by and large, they don't correspond to any obvious sort of go-term enrichment or anything like that. But we can use this to generate a list of candidate genes that we can follow up with, and this is something my lab is doing now, although we've had limited success. And then finally, if we look at individual alleles and we ask what's happening to them over time, we again see some evidence that polymorphism is maintained despite a really long, or a relatively long, I won't say very long, selection regime, right? So this is the most significant marker in that peak C, and I'm plotting here allele frequencies in the ancestor and all three of these time points. And so you can see, you know, of course, these replicates are similar to one another in their allele frequencies. That's how we identified them. But they don't approach, they approach fixation, but they seem to kind of flatten out at really high allele frequencies, and they don't reach complete fixation. And so it's still unclear if a longer experiment would see a continuation of this plateau or not. But for at least hundreds, the first 500 or so generations of evolution, polymorphism is maintained. So again, I'm going to return to these three questions that I started out with. How repeatable is evolution? We saw lots of evidence of repeatability in terms of evolution on standing variation, and we did not see very much evidence at all of heterogeneity among replicates. We tried several things to test for that. So there were no new mutations, for example, that were private to individual replicates. And we didn't detect a clear signal that some of the replicates were behaving in a way that was different than any of the others at any given site. I think that with this experiment, we did much better at localizing QTL. Now we have a handful of peaks and just a couple dozen SNPs to go in and query. And in terms of the origins and fates of adaptive alleles, well, now, of course, we have stronger inference to address both of these questions, because we have the ancestor, the actual ancestor, that we can sequence. And so we have information about the genome before the selection experiment started. So we have more context in terms of excluding, in terms of assessing the relative contribution of sort of de novo beneficial mutations versus standing variation. And overwhelmingly, we think that standing variation is driving adaptation. And in terms of the fates of adaptive alleles, again, we think that that polymorphism is being maintained, and there are several fascinating possibilities why that might be the case, but we haven't completely ruled out the possibility that this just wasn't a long enough experiment. So one more point I wanted to make about this experiment before we break for coffee, and that's just that, you know, in the first experiment I showed you, you know, we had sort of among the best evolution experiments that exist in the fly world, right? We had five replicates, and if you will, two time points. We had a selected genome-wide data from a selected line and a control line. So while it's not sort of ancestor and evolved, these are the two points of comparison. And now we have a very different experiment with yeast, where there were 12 replicates and four time points, including the ancestor. And so we wanted to know what would happen if we randomly removed elements of the data so that this data set sort of matched the fly data set in terms of its parameter space. And when we remove seven replicates and two time points, so if we simulate the situation where there are only five replicates and only two time points, which is the first story I told you about today, all of this signal goes away. And so I think this really highlights the utility of data from multiple time points in evolve and resequence projects and from independent replicates. And so this is a real demonstration, an empirical demonstration, that the nature to which these experiments are replicated determines the scope of what we can learn about them. And this really, I was happy to see that you know, a couple of papers, some modeling papers have come out recently. You know, one from Koffler and Schlatter, one from Baldwin Brown, Long and Thornton, published together in the same issue of MBE, that both simulate experimental evolution in sexual diploids and come to largely the same conclusions, which is that if we want power to detect the region's underlying change in these projects, we need to aim for effective population sizes on the order of 1,000. The number of independent replicates you know, should be greater than 12 even, maybe approaching or exceeding 25. And many generations more than 500. And I know that these are difficult to achieve, right? In flies, but not impossible.
Well, we didn't say this. We said they're low budget things.
And so as just the very final slide, I hope you'll indulge me. I know it's getting close to coffee time, but I'd just like to make this point. This was an interesting construct that came up at a meeting I went to recently, a NESET meeting for long-term evolution experiments. I know some of you in this audience attended that. And I really liked this construct, which is that you can think about experimental evolution parameter space as a three-dimensional parameter space. And you can pick any three parameters that are important to you, right? And so for me, that might be, well, effective population size, and we would make that one axis. Frequency of sex, since I'm interested in the evolution of sexual populations, that's an important parameter to me. Another one is number of independent replicates, because as I've shown, that really matters. And if you think about these three specific parameters as like a cube, and you think about all the experiments that have been done, many by people in this room, what happens is that we get a lot of experiments, a lot of individual observations that map to one corner of this cube, one apex. So over here would be the Lenski-style E. coli experiments, where we have big population sizes and the possibility for lots of independent replicates because of how practical and high throughput it is to handle E. coli, but no sex, right? And then on the other side, on the complete opposite side of the cube, we have experiments that are done in sexual organisms. So we have lots of sex in organisms like flies. They're obligately sexual. But it's harder to maintain large population sizes or many independent replicates. And so yeast inhabit, and C. elegans too, inhabit this nice, and I would argue, underexplored parameter space in the middle of this cube, and I think that actually our optimal space for detecting evidence of change is probably over here. But yeast can move along any of these three axes in a way that is experimentally tractable. And I'm certainly not the only one who is exploiting this. There are many people in this room who are doing experiments with yeast in this way. But I think it's important to highlight that, this is an underexplored parameter space. And then I'm going to acknowledge the many people who helped with this work, notably Michael Rose at UC Irvine, and all of the people associated with his lab. Joe Graves is the first author on some of the papers that are coming out now with the genomics of many other lines. Tony Long at Irvine was involved in that work too, and as my postdoc advisor was instrumental in all the work that I talked about today, including the yeast stuff. And of course Gianni has been instrumental in getting the yeast stuff up off the ground too. And with that, I'll conclude, and I'll take any questions if there's time before talking.
In your yeast experiments, have you come across a situation where you saw that the beneficial mutation was present in two of the strains, or were all of them where the beneficial mutation was restricted to a single strain?
So I think the problem when we looked for individual mutations that weren't present in the ancestor is they were always present in more than one of the experimental.
No, I don't mean new mutations. I mean that you could have basically the beneficial mutation could be present on two of your five strains or whatever.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so most of the SNPs were private to a single founder, but not all. I think about 75% of them were private. So occasionally we would get, the case where there's two and two. But those didn't seem to show up. Only one of those showed up in the haplotype analysis. Only one peak where there were two haplotypes contributing to the same to the adaptive response.
You made throughout the talk some references to the repeatability of the evolution and saying that yes, it's repeatable. But I want to challenge the room a little bit on that, because I don't know in the fly situation that you can actually say anything at all, because you've pooled all your replicates, so you don't know.
Well, originally, but then we haven't.
But still, I mean, everybody says, as soon as they find something that's happened more than once, they say, oh, evolution is quite repeatable. But what's the expectation? And without a strong model for how repeatable things should be, it's hard to know whether what we observe is more frequent or more parallel or less parallel, for example. And so I think that's, and throughout the literature, every time they say, oh geez, stickleback body armor has decreased every time it's gone from marine to freshwater. So, yeah, that's probably pretty good evidence of phenotypic repeatability.
Well, I think these experiments definitely demonstrate the repeatability of phenotypic evolution. That is sort of beyond dispute. But at the genomic level, it's tricky, right? Because you have these evolution experiments and asexual systems that have to proceed mutation by mutation. And largely, my read on that literature is that evolution at the nucleotide level is not very repeatable because it's about the first mutation, not necessarily the best mutation. On the other hand, in these experiments with sexual populations, we have a different problem, which is that population sizes are not necessarily big enough for beneficial mutations to arise, and so they're restricted to adaptation via standing variation, and that we would expect to be quite repeatable, because if the same, the same variants that are intermediately beneficial are present in multiple replicates, why wouldn't they all just increase in the same way? And that's what we've seen. At the same time, I think that it is a bit tricky to make generalizations across those two realms of literature because of the inherent limitations in both of them.
Oh. Yeah, I think it's a fair question, and it is hard across these different systems. We had a paper, I have to be reminded of the date, it was in 2008, where Andrew Rambo provided a prediction on using our data in virus populations, can we be strong in concluding that it was really repeatability due to beneficial mutations that we observed, and how much epistasis could we infer from it? And I can't even describe how my co-author did this, but the point is I don't see very much of that in the literature. Maybe other people can tell me I'm wrong in the room.
We did a review with Tuma Batayon and my publisher Susan Bailey on this, on the microbial stuff, on the bacterial experiment structure. And the trick there is you have to take account of mutation rates as well.
Yep.
So anyway, but I don't want to go too deep into this unless it might be something for a conversation later. But I think that claim that, oh geez, evolution is repeatable, is always made, but without a lot of, there's not a lot of strength of inference. The strength of inference around that is quite weak.
Well, we need more highly replicated experiments.
I want to follow up on Christian's question about the amount of drift. I mean, you're saying like vector population size around 1,000 flies in the fly.
That's our best guess, yeah.
I mean, so then you're expecting like for intermediate frequency alleles, like a 1% drift change every generation, and at 600 generations, I mean, they should, like, the different replicates should be in totally different spots at neutral alleles. But you're saying that they're like almost the same all the replicates.
Yeah. Right.
Any idea what's going on there?
It's very sure. Repeated.
Selection?
Or a little bit of migration.
Only within treatment.
Within treatment, yeah, but the treatment, it's treatments, it's hard for a fly to reproduce in one of the treatments they aren't from.
Okay.
So you're going to have more.
That's a good point, yeah.
So a lot of people in this room don't work with flies, but they have little wings, right?
I've worked in the same building as a fly.
Hey, if you work in the same building with a fly, you see them in your coffee or your soda or your fruit, right? I mean, it's a little hard to make migration zero.
But the distance between the replicates, so I mean, I caused this contamination when I did this experiment. I don't know whether I'm allowed to say this in this room.
Sure, whatever you call it. Like we call it contamination yeast and flies. We call it a migration event because it's between two. But it's in flies, I think it can't go as low as it can in yeast, maybe. Or bacteria, where there's ways you can.
All right, maybe one last question before coffee.
So, I think I'm missed a little bit, and it's related to this discussion that we've been having. When it comes to the repeatability, so I guess the repeatability is some of these regions, the repeatability is in like the regions that seem to have some selected, they seem to be under selection, so there's a different heterozygosity. And so that could be explained by selection, and then overall decay or heterozygosity patterns in these big windows should be very repeatable, even if it was purely drift, because heterozygosity would go down. But then the individual nucleotide changes in directions, even though you expect heterozygosity to go down on average, the changes would be in different directions on all these putatively neutral SNPs. So in that sense, if you actually look at the changes in SNPs that you somehow think are neutral, or even just most SNPs, you would still expect to be changing in different directions in a significant way. And so then in that sense, it shouldn't be repeatable, right? Even these experiments.
Let's see if I'm following your question. So you're saying, what do we do if we take the alleles that where there's no evidence for differentiation, so potentially neutral, and look at that?
So this question about drift and repeatability, drift is highly predictable in the sense that it leads to overall average reduction in heterozygosity. So a big window that has a bunch of SNPs at heterozygosity should go down unless there was a neutral SNP. And if this was the same neutral SNP in replicates, then the heterozygosity pattern should be very repeatable. But the actual changes in frequency of the neutral SNPs should all be going in different directions in your replicates. So that's when we're talking about repeatability and what the expectations for drift, they seem to be these two different things. So I was wondering if you do see that, these two different things happening. And so there's this repeatable sense in one sense, but then it's not repeatable in the sense of the neutral SNPs changing in different directions.
It's repeatable in terms of heterozygosity, but how repeatable is it in terms of allele frequency?
Mm-hmm. Right, of neutral.
Okay, yeah. I don't know. I guess I'd have to go back and...
That's what you showed, that it was repeatable at the level of allele changes. Yeah, I mean, you were comparing, when you did the comparison between the single replicate and the pooled one, that wasn't like looking at heterozygosity levels, I was looking at allele frequencies and asking about allele frequencies significantly different. So you were showing that the single replicate was just tracking the overall
one. Window. It's a window-based approach, so you're averaging.
Okay. Okay, but still, you know,
it's and it's 1/5 of the pool.
Right.
Right. So it's like awkward.
Yeah.
So, but still, I think if there's, if it's really true that there's considerable migration,
think, yes,
then your replicates would not be independent.
Absolutely.
Also
that makes tons of sense. That makes tons of sense that they're just migrating. Yeah.
But that's it's a bit of a fudge, right? But yeah.
Why don't I suggest we continue over coffee?